Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
I'm Jody Dean, and I'm a professor at Hobart and William Smith Colleges and an author of multiple books in political theory.
My name is Brian Becker. I'm the co-director of the Answer Coalition and also the one of the founders of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. I'm the author of several books, the latest being Imperialism in the 21st Century.
Well, we will get to imperialism shortly. But so I wanted to start out with you two are part of the group convening the People's Congress of Resistance in September. So tell us to start with a little bit about how the idea came together to do this event.
Okay, well, why don't I begin briefly and then let Jody jump in. We've both been partnering along with a number of other co-conveners for the past almost 6 months now. It was obvious, certainly, the moment that Donald Trump was elected, that a massive grassroots resistance movement had come into being, resisting against Trump's odious and reactionary and racist and misogynist policies. I could use many other adjectives, but people were in the streets instantly. They were in the airports. They were reacting en masse to Trump's plans to take this country back many decades. And the demonstrations were such in terms of magnitude that perhaps as many as one out of every three people in the country had participated in a protest. But we saw that this protest movement was also being, at least in its attempt, co-opted by Democratic Party elites who are trying to and saw in the movement a vessel for their own electoral goals in 2018 and 2020. And also, they almost instantly turned the resistance against Trump, which was progressive and grassroots and made up of frontline fighters, into something that was more or less reactionary by focusing on the one part of Trump's policy or announced policy, which was to improve relations with Russia, as something that was treasonous and traitorous and something that was certainly impeachable, and played into the Democratic Party's narrative that the reason Trump won, he of course being the most unpopular candidate in U.S. history, and the reason Hillary Clinton lost was because of the collusion of foreign powers. Right. So we felt the need to create a poll within the grassroots resistance movement that gave a coherent political vision. We thought activism by itself will not necessarily lead to the profound radical change in the political revolution that millions, tens of millions have been clamoring for as expressed during the Bernie Sanders campaign, but could be rendered harmless and co-opted by the Democratic Party. So the People's Congress of Resistance came together by conveners who are activists and organizers and leaders who said, look, Trump is a problem, but he's not the only problem. Mm-hmm. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party elites, those who dominate the political system, are in fact the problem. And the Congress represents those two parties and their lockhold over the political process in America. So we're creating something different, an alternative to the Congress, which is a Congress led by and supporting of the billionaire class in America. A People's Congress would be made up of frontline resistors whose voice is never heard in Congress and who are never represented in Congress. That's how the idea got started.
Okay, so I'll just add two things to what Brian said. First, we all saw what happened to the resistance this spring when Hillary Clinton said she was part of the resistance. I mean, that was the most blatant kind of co-optation of grassroots politics into the Democratic Party. And it was about then as well that the effort stopped being really visible as a radical pushback against elite politics, the politics of the millionaire class in general. Yeah. So it's important that there be a much more radical statement.
And then the second part is more down to earth from the local level, where I live in Geneva, New York. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we found in local level resistance is that the weekly protest in front of our member of Congress office, he's Tom Reed, he's been one of Trump's right-hand man, a total supporter from early on, yeah. Never said a word against it. The politics of that response of protesting Trump in front of Reed's office kept becoming vaguer and vaguer. Mm-hmm. And it kept becoming things like love Trump's hate, which is not a politics at all. Mm-hmm. And the protests then were becoming weaker and weaker. And so it was clear that the energy of resistance was getting fragmented, dispersed, vaporized, and that it was time to rechannel these energies back in a more radical direction. Mm-hmm.
And so tell us a little bit about the planning that's been going on. This is going to be a weekend event, but what's it going to look like?
We're expecting somewhere between 700 and 1,000 people. It'll take place at the Blackburn Center at Howard University in Washington, D.C. We believe we'll have representation for almost all 50 states. We've spent a lot of time doing organizing and mobilizing and outreach to the areas where the progressive left movement is not strong, but where many progressive and left activists are fighting. In other words, we've been going into red areas and red states. We hope to make the red states really red someday because the oppression and the suffering of the people is so great, but the political organized left has been weak there for a long time, and it wasn't always weak there, but it has been recently. So we've done a lot of organizing and outreach, and I think it'll be an assembly that, unlike many sort of traditional leftist gatherings, will have a very large component of working class people, a large number of Black and Latino people, poor white people from different areas of the country, again, areas that are dominated by red Republican politics. Mm-hmm. In terms of the planning, we have a very good group of conveners who have come together, people who don't have an identity of views on all things, but have united around the manifesto that has been issued because we believe it gives coherence to the political revolution and definition to the political revolution, which was a vague but popular formulation during the Sanders campaign. Mm-hmm. We've been meeting together for many, many months, going through and sort of hammering out what it is that we all stand for, what our common ground is. We're just working this week in terms of looking at all of the different parts of the Congress. We will, of course, it'll be partly a speak out from those whose voice is never heard in the U.S. Congress, from the grassroots. It'll be partly deliberative in terms of coming up with plans so that we can build a People's Congress movement that goes beyond the event itself at Howard University. In other words, we want to organize around the manifesto in particular because we believe that activism by itself, as great as that is, if it doesn't have a rudder, if it doesn't know where it's going, where it doesn't have a coherent goal, will ultimately ebb, as all mass movements do ebb. And it will be dissolved into those who are actually providing leadership. And I think, as Jody said, the Democratic Party is poised to co-opt and take advantage of all of this energy. Mm-hmm. And we want the manifesto around which we're organizing, similarly as it happened in the Labour Party in the UK with Jeremy Corbyn's surprising surge there, to become a point of focus where people really talk about it, they educate each other, they study together, and they use it. And as we coordinate with and show solidarity with all of the grassroots resistance movements that are going on every day, we don't need to start them up. They've already started. But we want to integrate the manifesto concept and this concept of an independent political movement into that kind of work. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so let's talk about the manifesto. And as you noted, right, you mentioned the political revolution terminology from the Bernie campaign. The manifesto says for politics for the many, echoes of the Corbyn campaign and the Corbyn manifesto. So talk a little bit about this, the manifesto that you guys put out and how that was put together. And then I want to talk about more specifically about some of the facets of it.
So one thing, in addition to having resonances with the Corbyn campaign, I think another site of resonance is with the platform of the International Women's Strike mm-hmm. Committee, particularly in the U.S. organizing, which was a really tremendous platform and document. And I mean, we did, again, in my small town, we did organizing via or around the women's strike using that platform because we thought that what was so strong about it was that it gave a politics of the 99% to the January 21st or January 22nd women's strike, right? That, you know, that was pretty open and vague. And for some people, it seemed like a Hillary kind of event. But what the International Women's Day strike campaign or platform did was actually give a strong anti-racist, anti-capitalist, anti-transphobic politics to that, right? It gave it a kind of a socialist substance. So that's another one of the currents that goes into the manifesto for the People's Congress, right? The Society for the Many. And I think that the substance of it has many currents that go into it, and also really reflects the diversity from the conveners, right? Where folks who've been involved in Stop Police Terror, people have been heavily involved in immigrant struggles, feminist work, Native American work. The plethora of actual frontline struggles on the left that somehow get disarticulated at the national level, right? At the mm-hmm. national level, people tend to present all of these different strengths as if they were opposed to one another. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that all of these struggles actually are struggling for a real society of the many gets lost. Yeah. And so that's one of the things that having this diverse bunch of conveners help to present is so like, yes, these are, you know, these are different elements of what's actually a thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So we're talking the morning after Trump made his latest Afghanistan speech. So feel like we should start with imperialism, largely because, you know, the Obama years, we saw that really fade. And there have been some recent studies and writing about how people missed that one of the things that really turned people off to Hillary Clinton was that they thought she was hawkish. And of course, Trump is going in the same or an even, you know, more imperialist direction than Clinton after all of that. But we're still looking at this, these left movements that have had a hard time in the past few years really integrating a critique of American imperialism into their work. So I would love for you both to talk about how that has connected with the, or how that fits into this manifesto and how you see that fitting into the resistance work people are now doing.
Well, on my part, I think it's critically important. I think that there's a tendency by socialists who want to be reach into a broader mass of the population to downplay U.S. imperialism and U.S. foreign policy. So there's a tendency to deal with bread and butter issues and social justice issues at home and sort of turn away from or in some cases embrace imperialist foreign policy so as not to become, quote, isolated. This is a death knell for the movement. We live in the center of world imperialism. The idea that we can fight for housing rights or social justice or higher wages or community control of the police and not talk about U.S. imperialism is not only naive, but it actually leads the movement straight into the graveyard because the imperialist foreign policy of this country so dominates politics and becomes a rallying point for the Democratic and Republican elites to reach into and amongst the masses of people and generate a national chauvinism and a reactionary patriotism and an embrace of imperialist concepts. And we must, as a movement, tackle this straight on. So right now we're going to focus a lot on imperialism and solidarity with the people in Venezuela and the people in Latin America who want to be independent and free. We're going to demand the U.S. get out of the Middle East. We're going to demand the closing of the military bases. They're not for national defense. They're not national security. The last time the U.S. mainland was invaded was the War of 1812. These are imperial outposts for U.S. imperial domination. And we want to preach the message that working people in America have more in common with the working folks in other countries who are targeted by U.S. imperialism than we do with the military-industrial complex.
I'll add that one of the things that is interesting once one starts thinking about how left politics is built out of frontline struggles, then you start to see that anti-imperialism is already imminent within it. So, for example, all climate politics requires a global approach, right? We cannot get to a solution to dealing with climate change if U.S. imperialism is dominating global politics, right? Dealing with climate change must be global, and it requires a cooperative effort. And you don't get to cooperate with people if you're bombing them, right? That's all, or in trade war or whatever, right? So already climate change politics, emphases on environmental justice have a global frame. So that's one thing. The same thing with anti-racist politics, right? Anti-racist politics is really quite explicit that it's not just a politics that seeks equality for Black and brown people in the U.S., right? You can't be, you know, killing brown people all over the world if your politics is anti-racist. So that automatically opens up to an anti-imperialist politics. The same thing with feminism, right? What's really been crucial to so many feminists who take a more global perspective is the way that U.S. imperialist policies facilitate impoverishment of women all over the world, violence against women all over the world. And so the anti-imperialism actually is a current already in the movements, and bringing them together helps draw that out.
Yeah. So one of the other things that one of the other parts of the platform is, well, there are quite a few that I want to talk about, but I was thinking about connecting the dots to imperialism abroad is the question of mass incarceration and policing at home. And we've seen in the last, you know, week or so, the fact that aggressive policing against Black people's movements and the very, very hands-off policing of the white supremacists who marched on Charlottesville this weekend, they're very different things. And so, yeah, I wonder if you could talk about what we're seeing in terms of people's understanding of this issue changing, especially given that, you know, the police are one of Trump's biggest supporters and the faction that he's, you know, consistently sort of catered to and gave his big dramatic speech telling the police that bashing people's heads into cars or something was a great idea.
I mean, I think it's been clear to people of color all over the country that the police don't work for them, right? That the police reinforce a version of state power that is white supremacist. And many white people have been able to deny that or repress that or try to say, oh, well, you know, that's only in some extreme cases. It's not the norm. It's not okay. I mean, it's not really okay, but it's an exception. And we've been seeing this now for a while, right? Ferguson was one of the more recent eruptions of this into public consciousness on one side, and then we see it with respect to really enabling the direct assertion of white supremacy in Charlottesville. So in some ways, it's more like the confrontation is in mainstream politics, and it's an eruption of what has been known for quite a while as the basic condition of policing in the U.S.
The American capitalism has some unique characteristic features. For the past 400 years, since it was implanted on the territory of North America, American capitalism has been based on the enslavement of African people and on the, of course, the theft of indigenous people's lands and then their ultimate genocide. America was a police state, a racist, apartheid, slave state for the majority of Black people for the past four centuries. It's a lesser part of the country's history where civil rights and Black people being treated as equal citizens, at least in the law, has existed. It's only since 1964 that apartheid has been legally banned in America. Right. And so we have a situation where one out of every four prisoners in the world, one out of every four are incarcerated in the United States, 2.3 million people. Another 5 million are somehow connected to the law enforcement system, either probation or parole. That's a huge part of the population. Disproportionately Black people, because the police state that always existed for Black people still exists, because Black communities are so heavily policed that they resemble nothing other than an occupation force. And thus the majority of arrests happen in the Black community. Of course, poverty exists all over the country in Black and white communities, but Black communities are heavily, heavily policed. And I think it's a conscious decision by the capitalist so-called justice system to contain the Black population, because the Black population has been the motor force for movements for social change over the past centuries. And so, of course, at the People's Congress of Resistance, we're going to have many ex-prisoners. We're going to have many prisoner families there. We're going to have the representations from political prisoners. We're going to have many families. I've just been on the phone, at least 10 families, 10 moms whose children were killed by the police in the last year or two. They're coming. They're mobilizing. We're raising money for them to come from all over the country. So this will be a preeminent part of the People's Congress. Again, the U.S. Congress, there's no poor people there. There's no immigrants there. There's no locked up dreamers there. And for the most part, there's no working class folks. And of course, the Black community has been historically underrepresented. So this will be a big part of what's going to happen in Washington, D.C. on September 16th and 17th at the People's Congress.
Yeah, I think connected to that, obviously, we're talking about you include reparations and Native sovereignty in this piece. And, you know, there's this tendency right now from certain parts of the left to think that and argue that, and even sort of Bernie Sanders said this on the campaign trail, right, that concepts like this are going to be divisive and that you can't talk about them because something, something, it's going to scare people off. So I wanted to ask you about sort of foregrounding those, putting those in very specific items in the manifesto right up top.
I mean, if we think about a society for the many in the United States, right, what does that have to look like? Right? It has to look like the society that people would want to produce. And if we're going to produce one that that is desirable, a good place to live, then we have to confront directly and honestly the dual legacy of the U.S. founding, which was in slavery and genocide. Right? So the most direct ways that we have of confronting head on the fact that the country is anchored in slavery and genocide is by taking up the two answers that have been put forward to the left as just the starting point for confronting it, which is namely the Native American sovereignty and reparations. So that's the way that you can even start the conversation of how do we build a society for the many. It's like confront the basic crimes that have been at the basis of U.S. of the entire country.
Quickly, I want to just say, yeah. You know, the people who say that reparations for Black people, for Black America, or for instance, will alienate people, they're not talking about Black people.
Why, which people could we be thinking about alienating?
They're talking about a segment of society. So, yeah. It also demonstrates who we're aiming for. In other words, to build a really powerful, viable social movement, yes, we want people from all classes and all sectors to be it, but the things that really make history change are when the masses of people, meaning the poorest, the most oppressed, those sectors of society, come onto the political stage. That's why that sort of semi-revolution, the civil rights revolution, happened. From when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat to a white man, she was already, she gave that seat up. I mean, the next 9 years, the masses of people came into politics. And so the Congress of the United States was compositionally the same as it was when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat in 1955. 9 years later, voted for the Civil Rights Act and then the Voting Rights Act, the two most progressive pieces of social legislation. It was because the poor, the working class, the masses, the Black community in particular, and all of the people who joined with them came into political life. That's what makes change possible. And so that's who we're orienting towards with the People's Congress. And none of the people who really want to embrace the Congress will be alienated by this demand.
We started out talking about a little bit about the echoes of Corbyn. One of the things that was really striking about the Corbyn manifesto was that a major political party was calling for renationalizing industries, was calling for collective ownership. So I want to wrap up here by talking about that plank in your platform and why we should be talking about things like nationalizing things, collectivizing the banks. Nationalize Amazon is my favorite demand, certainly. But
I want to approach that question a little bit from the side. In social conversations, like family events and stuff, and random conversations, like in gas stations, I've ended up talking to some Trump supporters, and they always say something like, "What we really need is the government to be run like a business."
Yeah.
Right? We really need a businessman in charge. And then one person says that's the good thing about Trump. And another one's like, well, you know, yeah, he's not doing well, but I could never run my business that way. He needs to do X, Y, and Z to run his business differently. And the thing is, if you think about it, actually, the capitalist economy is terrible. It destroys more wealth than it produces, as we saw really directly in the 2008 crash, where trillions left the economy. More and more people are thrown out of the workforce. It produces all sorts of waste goods that nobody needs. And so people say the government is like a business. No, it's ridiculous. So the thing to think about is, in fact, how badly capitalism works, how badly businesses are run, right? Everybody is miserable about all sorts of different aspects, whether or not it's cable companies, airplane transportation, the fact that so many goods fall apart so easily, the fact that things are, that we've got all sorts of bizarre kinds of plastic all over everything that's adding to environmental waste and giving more incentives for there not to be a cap on the production of fossil fuels. So if we think about how capitalism is run, it's an utter disaster. And so in fact, what we need is the democratic people's control for people's interest of the basic system of production in the country. Capitalism is in a crisis right now. We've got a financial market that's out of control. We have an inability of the capitalist system to deal with climate change. That's is why we actually see the fragmentation of the two major parties, is that they're not able to grapple with the kind of crisis that capitalism is in. So we begin with nationalizing the industry with you know, all of the major sectors of the economy, because that's the only way we're going to be able to move forward.
So how can people get involved? How can people attend the Congress, find out more information?
The principal way right now is for people to go to the website, congressofresistance.org. It's all one word, congressofresistance.org. The site has the manifesto. It has the conveners. It has our call to action, our vision. It also has logistics information. If you're coming, you can register online. If we have a registration, two registration fees, $50 or $100. If you can't pay anything, no one's going to be turned away because of lack of funds. That's why we set the registration fee high. Mm-hmm. We have low rent hotels there on the website. So it's all there. Congressofresistance.org. People are coming from all parts of the country. I mean, we're having car caravans. It's so exciting. Car caravans come from like all over the country where people are stopping town after town, picking up some more people and then heading to Washington. So it's going to be a real grassroots frontline assembly.
Excellent. Excellent. And how can people keep up with the two of you?
Can you say it again, Sarah?
Oh, I said, how can people keep up with the two of you?
I'm on Facebook and Twitter, and I have a blog, but I don't really use it. So.
Yeah, and I'm also on Facebook, and my email for people who want to reach back to me directly is brianbecker2000@yahoo.com.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Fayebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.